Okay, boys and girls, that goes out to the She-Wolves this week, Friday, Freya's Day, Day of the She-Wolves. There you go. But don't get upset. I have not gone soft on you because I'm going to put something else on here from the Pope of the Church of What's Happening Now for War, White Aryan Resistance.
Now, there's something else that is said after a death. But this one involves belief, which is where I begin to have big problems. This one happens after the funeral, after the burial, back at the house. Back at the house where the family and friends and the loved ones of the deceased are having some food and drink and enjoying some warm reminiscences of the person who passed away. Sooner or later, someone is bound to say the following, especially after a few drinks. You know, I think he's up there now, smiling down at us. And I think he's pleased. Now, first of all, there is no up there. For people to be smiling down from. It's poetic, it's quaint, and I guess for superstitious people it provides a little comfort, but it doesn't exist. But if it did, and if someone did somehow survive death in a non-physical form, I personally think he'd be far too busy with other celestial activities than to be standing around paradise, smiling down. On live people. What kind of a fucking eternity is that? And why is it no one ever says, I think he's down there now, smiling up at us? Apparently it never occurs to people that their loved ones might be in hell. Your parents could be in hell right now. Your parents and your father for sure. Oh, shit, hell is full of dads. Full of dads. Even the ones who took you to the ball game. Just for beating the shit out of you once too often. And fucking the neighbor lady. And fucking the neighbor dog. And who knows, maybe even fucking the UPS man. We'll never know what mischief Dad was up to. Parents in hell. Kind of gives you a nice feeling, doesn't it? It does me. Grandparents in hell. Picture that. Picture your grandmother in hell. Baking pies without an oven. And if someone were in hell, I doubt very seriously he'd be smiling. I think he's down there now, screaming up at us. And I think he's in severe pain. People just refuse to be realistic. They don't like to be realistic. People would rather stroke themselves. You know, oh, they like to stroke themselves. Don't they stroke themselves? They stroke each other. They get stroked. They stroke the boss strokes them. Everybody strokes everybody. It's nothing but a big stroke job in this country. The government strokes you every day of your life. Religion never stops stroking you. Big business gives you a good stroke, and it's one big transcontinental cross-country red, white, and blue stroke job. Do you know?
And that is the Pope of my church. The church is what's happening now, boys and girls. Ha, ha, ha. Good morning. I heard out of the corner of my ear yesterday that one of the vice presidential candidates' plane slid off the runway at some airport. Ha, oh, I was crossing my fingers on that one. Finally gotten so bad in Washington that vice president means something. He's in charge of vice. How about that? Well, let's talk a little about that word, that dreaded word, religion. Yeah. At first glance, the Egyptian pantheon presents a bewildering array of gods having little in common with the Christian God-man. But properly understood, many Egyptian deities were city or regional variations on a theme, gods whose fortunes rose and fell with the outcome of human power struggles and dynastic change. I would insert here, as America turns more and more non-white, and especially with Asian influences, Christianity will gradually evolve into more of an using an Asian religion. That's my opinion. Triumphant priests merged useful aspects of a fallen's rival deity with their own favored god. The process of absorption, assimilation, and adaptation continued throughout the Greek, Roman, and Christian eras. Though the basic Christ legend was formulated by apostate Jews with their expectations of a conquering Messiah, and pagan converts with their fables of dying and reborn sun gods, Egypt provided Christianity with ideas not found in the Old Testament. Immortality of the soul, judgment of the dead, reward and punishment, a triune God. The ancient religion of Egypt infused the nascent faith of Christ with much of its creed, conjuring up Christianity. Following the breakup of the empire of Alexander the Great, his general Ptolemy, 223 to 282 BC, took possession of Egypt, Palestine, and Cyprus, Alexandria, his capital. Built on a spit of land unaffected by the Nile floods between Lake Maritoas and the Mediterranean, traded the wealth of Egypt with the Greek world to the north and the east. The great port became the hub of commerce between Europe, Asia, India, and beyond. Settlers arrived from more ancient Greek cities, bringing Hellenic culture with them. Ptolemy himself encouraged artists and scholars from all nations to continue their work in his cosmopolitan city, and with royal patronage, Alexandria became the intellectual capital of the ancient world. A new syncretic culture emerged. Along with the trade goods of Alexandria flowed every philosophy and creed known in that part of the world. Among this most cosmopolitan of city religions mingled and mixed and borrowed freely from ancient faiths of Egypt itself. Accessible even today, the catacombs of Alexandria graphically illustrate the cultural fusion of the Roman era. Greek sarcophagi guarded by Egyptian gods in Roman military uniform. The Greeks created the universal god. The Greek general Ptolemy styled himself as an Egyptian pharaoh and took the title Soter, or savior. As the astute ruler, he understood the political value of the official religion. A single composite deity, one god, one all-embracing system of belief, might unify the diverse, often antagonistic peoples of his polyglot empire and strengthen their devotion to the god's earthly representation, himself. The first pharaoh wanted a single composite god to bring together his diverse subjects. In a classic example of the process of syncretism, the character and the characteristics of several early gods were rolled into one, the god Serapis. Of all the pharaonic Greek gods, Serapis survived the longest, well into the Roman period. Infusing the character of so many earlier gods into Serapis, the practice of virtual monotheism was established in Alexandria over several hundred years. The new god embodied aspects of many earlier deities, including the Egyptian Osiris and Apis, and the Greek Dionysus and Hades, the Greek god to the underworld. The Ptolemies intended the new god should have universal appeal in an increasingly cosmopolitan country. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? In consequence, Serapis had more than 200 localized names, including, according to correspondence of the Emperor Hadrian, Christ. In the 3rd century B.C., the worship of Serapis became a state-sponsored cult together throughout Egypt. With the Roman conquest, the cult spread throughout the empire. Such a god, to enjoy universal acceptance and devotion, would necessarily possess all the powers and aspects of earlier ones to create the grand synthesis, in a process that anticipated the actions of the Roman Emperor Constantine several centuries later. Ptolemy put all the resources of the state behind the promotion and sponsorship of an official cult. The major temples of the god were built in Alexandria and Memphis. The Serapeum in Alexandria itself blended Egyptian gigantism with the grace and beauty of Hellenic style. The Serapeum grew into a vast complex, one of the grandest monuments of pagan civilization. And that's a few thoughts on religion there. We'll give you a lot more as time goes on. Show you how these filthy preachers and ministers and priests have perverted ancient myths into a modern myth and milked you dry, baby. Well, here's a guy I only partially agree with. Jewish decline and the rise of China in the U.S. Years ago, when I was a tech writer for weird magazines such as Signal and other more normal techish pubs, Jews littered the intellectual landscape. They were all over high-end research such as Bell Labs. The big names were often Jewish: Einstein, von Neumann, Feynman, Gell-Mann, Minsky. The staff list of the Manhattan Project read like a yeshiva yearbook. Well, thanks a lot, Jews, for giving us the atomic bomb. The same happened in the arts. Bernstein, Landowska, Rubinstein, Stoppard, Maidens in Search of Godhead, and vice versa. Jews were smart. Most people figured not necessarily liking it. I wondered why without great interest. Genetic determinists, of course, cooked up evolutionary explanations involving undiscovered genes acting upon an unquantifiable selective pressures to produce assumed results not correlated with the pressures. Business as usual. Well, I don't think so. I think you're way off base there. I think where the Jews picked up, a lot of their people picked up their genius was from Europe, from the Germans, that they were very much integrated into German society before World War II. Back around World War I, they were all over the place. So they got their educations and so forth in Europe and other European countries, in England and so forth. So they're carrying the genes of the Aryan race within them as Ashkenazis, I believe, and they don't even seem to realize it or want to give it credit. Anyhow, that's what I say. Later, I began to notice without thinking about it that the Jewish names were growing thin on the ground. These were not systematic observations, but Asian names were becoming prominent almost everywhere. The Feinsteins seemed to be in recession, if only anecdotally. Something odd was happening, I barely noticed. Well, that's why I say that China and Japan, those people, the higher end of the Asian families, are going to be back in resurgence big time, and plenty of people recognize that fact. But I think when people like this pissy little female that's trying to become president and swing her axe around, she's going to get a big surprise, the same she'll get with Russia. But with China, she's really going to get that surprise because she is pushing for more militarism, reaching into and around China. Now, if there's anybody going to slap the Jews down, it's going to be the Chinese. And if anybody's going to slap the blacks down, if they're in proximity, it'll be the Chinese. The Chinese are very intelligent in the fact that they are, instead of doing like we do, send foreign aid that just goes down the drain hole, they're building infrastructures in these countries. They're building infrastructures in all these African countries and by that way taking them over. But they do it in a less hostile way than American capitalism. And they're also building infrastructure like in the Philippines. That's why the Philippine leader, who has a 91% rate of support in the Philippines and is doing a lot of great things, is called the Chinese, and they've come in and they're building infrastructure in the Philippines more than the United States ever did. And so these countries are swinging towards China, and they don't care about this one man, one vote democracy sham and scam. They don't care. They're building railroads and buildings and all kinds of things and power structures and so forth, electricity. And these little countries that don't have much, that don't have much expertise, they don't give a shit if China is a dictatorship of the proletariat. They just want the good stuff, and they're smart doing that. Washington is simply carrying on this crap of crony capitalism and shuffling papers back and forth. Interesting. In the last couple of months, I've received mail from an inmate who was a guy who got pissed off with non-whites getting plastic surgery non-Aryans and making themselves look white. He was a great supporter of the beauty of the Aryan. So he went out and found a plastic surgeon, Jew plastic surgeon, that was doing all this kind of stuff, and he killed him. And now he's doing life in prison. But he wrote me a letter, and I wrote him back, and I said, I'm in agreement with you on your complaints about Aryan beauty. I once had a good friend, an activist in California. He lived on the beach and was obsessed with the white beauty, of course. He called his operation WATER, but I can't remember any more about the acronym and what it stood for. He became so obsessed with the problem that he committed suicide. He was a good-looking young man who had no trouble getting women. That upset me very much because he had so much to offer. While I have no qualms with someone who wants to commit suicide, I would expect it to be for something extremely important or something you had control over. Better yet, encourage your enemies to commit suicide. Unfortunately, without the power, demands mean nothing. You're probably better off to influence people one by one than to try to convert everybody all at once. The objections you have been going on for a long time, and it's going to take some severe re-education and years of re-education to change that problem. Yes, I'm amused also when black leaders make fun of his people for doing stupid things, aping the white man, so to speak. Take care.
Europe. Weimar Germany and Donald Trump. How traditional and radical conservatives come to speak a common political language that ultimately benefits the extremists. By Eric D. Weitz. Weimar Germany and Donald Trump. How traditional and radical conservatives come to speak a common political language that ultimately benefits the extremists. What a memorable day, wrote a middle-class Hamburg housewife in her diary on January 30, 1933. She had just watched the parade of torch-bearing stormtroopers celebrate Adolf Hitler's assumption of power in Germany. Frau Solmitz did not, however, extol only Hitler. She waxed melodic about Hitler's cabinet, in which there were just three Nazis. All the others were upstanding conservatives, men like Franz von Papen, the aristocratic former chancellor and leader of the Catholic Center Party, and the career bureaucrat Konstantin von Neurath, who was named to head up the foreign ministry. These were experienced men, reasonable men. They would contain Hitler's excesses. After 4 years of economic depression and political paralysis, 14 years since the humiliation of the Versailles Peace Treaty, decades of an overweening Jewish presence in German public life, it was time for a new beginning. It was time to make Germany great again. In the end, a small clique of businessmen, estate owners, bankers, high-ranking civil servants, and army officers prevailed upon the president, Paul von Hindenburg, to name Hitler Chancellor of Germany. For these traditional conservatives, the Nazis were uncouth, low-class, and undisciplined. Yet these same conservatives made a political bargain with the Nazi Party. Developed over the 14 years of the Weimar Republic, the bargain was created and then sealed through a common political language of utter disdain for the Republic, contempt for Jews, opposition to the Versailles Treaty, and hostility to democracy and socialism. Historical analogies are always fraught. No serious political movement today in the West is anything like the Nazi Party. But the process by which traditional and radical conservatives came together through a common language carries numerous warning signals as we experience the surge of right-wing populism from Poland across the continent, onto the United Kingdom, and across the ocean to the United States. Americans often say that the German people elected Hitler to power, but that is not accurate. The highest vote the Nazis received in a free election came 6 months before the seizure of power. In July 1932, the Nazis won 37% of the electorate. That represented a significant proportion of German voters, to be sure, but it was far from a majority. In a parliamentary system, as Germany was, 37% doesn't get you to power. In the next election in November 1932, their tally declined to 33%. In autumn 1932, it would have been reasonable to think that the Nazi wave had crested and that Hitler and the Nazi Party were on the decline. In fact, Hitler and his supporters feared as much. In the end, the conservative elite saved the Nazis from the political wilderness. There was nothing inevitable or predetermined about the Nazi assumption of power. It was the result of a conscious political decision by traditional conservatives made in a time of crisis when Germany wallowed in depression and the political system lay paralyzed. The conservative elite had its roots in the churches, Protestant and Catholic, and in the old tradition of state service in a monarchy and an authoritarian, lord of the manor practice that they then carried over, helped along by the new industrial bourgeoisie, to Germany's highly productive industrial economy. These traditionalists hated the very idea of democracy, but they understood that there had to be limits to state power, and they shied away from rampant, excessive violence. They also understood that human beings are imperfect and prone to error, and that the essential Nazi hubris was the belief in the perfectibility of the race. Yet the traditionalists struck a deal with the Nazis on January 30, 1933. One they reconfirmed many times during the 12 years of the Third Reich. The accommodation between traditional and radical conservatives began to take shape even before the end of World War I, before the Nazi Party even existed. It was a bargain shaped by a shared political language. Already in September 1918, 2 months before the signing of the armistice that ended the hostilities of World War I, 10 months before the proclamation of the Weimar Constitution and the formal founding of the Republic, the infamous stab in the back legend was underway. Hindenburg and Erich Ludendorff, the two officers who led the Supreme Military Command and effectively ruled Germany dictatorially in the last 2 years of the war, shifted the blame for Germany's defeat away from the military, and themselves, of course. The army had remained upright and upstanding, the army had never been defeated in the field, so they claimed. Germany had been betrayed at home by socialists and the Jews. That was the only reason Germany had to sue for peace. It was a nasty, dirty game, and highly potent politically. Hitler used the stab in the back legend to great effect. Traditional conservatives, including Hindenburg though not Ludendorff, who later dallied with the Nazis, also found the rhetoric highly appealing. After all, the representatives of the revolutionary government of the winter of 1918-19 had signed the armistice. The representatives of the Weimar Republic signed the Versailles Treaty. Those who had initiated and led Germany into the disastrous war remained nicely shielded from any responsibility. The Dolchstoßlegend marked the first moment of the political alliance between the traditionalists and the myriad radical conservative groups, including the Nazis, who quickly emerged after WWI. The Weimar Republic is often seen as merely a prelude to the Third Reich. But that reads back into the past Germany's later history. The Republic certainly suffered numerous crises and had a fragile character. Amid the chaos, Germans experienced the most democratic order they had ever known, a vibrant, thriving culture, and social improvements like public housing and public health clinics, which often dispensed sex and birth control advice. Many spheres of life largely closed off to Jews, like the universities, opened up, women obtained greater educational and professional opportunities. Weimar, in short, represented a great moment of democratic reform, cultural efflorescence, and sexual experimentation. It was everything that conservatives, traditional and radical, hated. The choice words they used in common for the Republic marked another step on the road of their accommodation. Skiberrepublik, Schmarrepublik, Rauberrepublik, Judenrepublik, and, perhaps the ultimate pejorative, Das System Profiteers Republic, Abusers Republic, Robbers Republic, Jew Republic, the system all served to delegitimize Germany's democratic system and all those associated with it, including liberals, socialists, and Jews. The respectable right-wing press propagated the terms of defamation, as did the radicals in their newspapers and propaganda broadsides. Priests and pastors thundered the terms from the pulpits. By the end of the 1920s, the new media technologies amplified sound, radio, and film made it possible to spread the language far and wide, as did the innovative political tactics of the Nazis, who agitated in neighborhoods and villages where no previous political parties had ventured. Then there was the Versailles Diktat, the dictated Treaty of Versailles. Probably the only political issue on which all Germans could agree was their distaste and dislike for the treaty that ended WWI. Certainly, the harsh terms the Allies imposed upon Germany were unwise. Most important, they severely hampered the democratic system that France, Britain, Italy, and the United States should have done their utmost to foster. Instead, the Allies handed ammunition to the enemies of the Republic, which also helped seal the bond between the traditional and the radical conservatives like the Nazis. Traditional conservatives were by and large genteel anti-Semites. In the Weimar period, they tended not to share the murderous tendencies of the Nazis, though that would change over the course of the Third Reich. But they didn't particularly like Jews, and they thought the Jewish presence in German public life overbearing and distasteful. Germany, in the common view of the right, radical and conservative, faced an Überfremdung, a flood of foreigners, Jews in particular, who exercised a degenerative influence on the German people and German society. The Jewish spirit, the Jewish threat to the national character, the degenerative Jewish race, Jews as the embodiment of finance capital as opposed to productive German capital. All this marked the language that joined the traditional as well as the radical right. On the one side were Germans, supposedly rooted in place, exemplars of moral rectitude, intelligent and productive. Across the divide, beyond the pale, were Jews, lacking a state of their own. They were everywhere and nowhere, predators and exploiters who despoiled Aryans. The ultimate sin, which the Nazis propagated so effectively, was to associate Jews and communism, the rootless, cosmopolitan Jew, with the place of the Soviet Union. On all this the old conservative elite and the Nazis could easily agree, even though the Nazi solution to the problem would prove more far radical than anything the traditionalists had imagined. Which brings us to the current right-wing populist surge all across Europe and the United States. Certainly, real grievances exist that have created support for the right. As one report after another recounts, many communities have been hard hit by globalization. The factories rust away, the jobs available are low-level, low-paying service positions. Inequalities have risen everywhere, most obscenely in the United States. Even Germany has developed a two-tier labor market, one segment well-protected and well-paid, the other comprising temporary and part-time workers who have little access to the country's vaunted social welfare programs and high wages. In the United States, commentators have suddenly woken up to the fact that the elite in both parties is well-heeled, well-situated, and out of touch with the economic dislocation experienced by so many people. And yet there exists the odd, uncomfortable fact that Western societies are notably well-off, and many right-wing populists are by no means destitute. Even Denmark and Austria, each a paradise of comfort and well-being, each harboring excellent school systems and extensive social welfare networks, have witnessed a right-wing surge. The much-touted report that the average Trump supporter earns $70,000 a year, not great, perhaps, but certainly not bad and significantly above the United States poverty level, marks further evidence that the discontent that feeds right-wing populism goes far beyond economics. In fact, economics is probably not the primary factor. Instead, the right-wing sensibility in the Western world is largely cultural in nature. It is directed against those identified as foreigners, even when they are third-generation Germans, French, or Britons, whose families may have hailed from Turkey, Morocco, or Jamaica. Race is also a factor, but not exclusively so. Many of those deemed foreign are of darker hues than the native-born. But the Brexit vote was also directed against Poles, Lithuanians, and other Europeans who could travel and settle freely in Britain as citizens of other European Union countries. The surge in refugees coming to Europe in the past year and a half has certainly exacerbated the hostilities against foreigners, but the sentiment existed well beforehand. Donald Trump and his European analogues express a deep contempt for foreigners, or those whom they deem to be foreigners. Sometimes the language is coded and comes across in polite terms. At other moments, it is virulent. The political language that they speak enables the creation of a broad-based right-wing populism. Respectable members of society in Poland, France, or the United States hear the coded language and nod their heads in approval, while those on the far right, prone to violence, respond affirmatively to the more virulent rhetoric. Trump, like many other right-wing leaders, plays both sides of the rhetorical street, as Hitler did as well, and masterfully so. His comments about Mexicans as rapists and drug dealers, judges with Hispanic roots as biased, and Muslims as inherently dangerous display his open racism. He implies that only white men are upstanding citizens, only they can be objective and be trusted to implement the law. America first, he rails, a seemingly reasonable slogan with which many people could agree. Trump seems blithely unaware of the tainted history of the term, which goes back to the isolationists, Nazi sympathizers, and anti-Semites of the 1930s and 40s. Make America Great Again is also code that plays well. Trump conjures up the 1950s, a wonderful decade for some in America, but certainly not for African Americans, who remain subject to Jim Crow legislation and violence of the worst sort in the South as well as the North, nor for Hispanics, who suffered all kinds of discrimination. In Europe, right-wing populists advance a similar language. Flood of foreigners means genocide, runs one hyperbolic placard from the nationalist far-right political group PEJADA, meaning, of course, the genocide of Germans. The name of the group is itself overheated and expressive of its bedrock hostility to immigrants. PEJADA stands for Patriotic Europeans Against the Islamicization of the West. Closely associated with the group is the Identity Movement, somewhat innocuous sounding but situated on the radical fringe and demanding a state that promotes German identity. France's National Front evinces the same mix of polite, general slogans that many French men and women could support, along with more bald-faced remarks openly hostile to immigrants, or, more accurately, those deemed immigrants, even though many are second, third, and even fourth-generation citizens. A national defense to protect France and defend the liberty of the nation, security, the first liberty, for an effective justice, for ecology and animal protection are slogans drawn from the National Front program, and they could be espoused by almost any French political party. But the program also descends into more openly hostile and aggressive phrases, such as stop immigration, reinforce French identity. Republicans in the United States continue to dance around Trump, many unable to decide whether their party should back such an obviously incapable, self-aggrandizing, and racist candidate for the presidency. A few individuals, like Senator Lindsey Graham and New York Times columnist David Brooks, have been highly critical of Trump and have refused to throw their weight behind him. But by and large, Republicans have moved into Trump's camp, Paul Ryan perhaps the most prominent among them. They bemoan the fact that they can't control him, but they don't have the courage to separate themselves from a candidate with substantial popular support. The Republicans who have sidled up to Trump are correct in this regard. They can't control him, and they shouldn't expect power to moderate him. University of Chicago legal scholar Eric Posner recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times in which he described what Trump could do with the executive power he will possess if he is elected. In a phrase, he can do a whole lot in regard to foreign and immigration policy and the naming of people to the federal judiciary. Ours is a presidential system, and despite the difficulties Bill Clinton and Barack Obama had with Congress and the Supreme Court, presidents wield enormous power. In possession of that power, Trump will be fully capable of shredding the Constitution from within, as the Nazis did. Today's Republicans and similarly minded figures in Europe are like the conservatives who put Adolf Hitler in power, delusional about their influence, playing dangerously with the structures of our democracy. Few Republicans in the United States are willing to follow Senator Graham on the exit ramp, as he termed it, from the Trump highway. And much of the reason lies in the fact that Trump's political language is only more blatant than what many Republicans have been saying for decades. That is the lesson from the right-wing populist upsurge in Weimar Germany, which culminated in the Nazi assumption of power. The political language of fear and hostility directed at foreign elements, never mind the fact that many and even most of those so-called foreigners had been residents and citizens for generations, enables moderate and radical conservatives to come together. The moderates make the radicals salon fatigue, acceptable in polite society. That is the real and pressing danger of the current moment.
Well, you want to roll the dice? I don't think we better roll the dice with this one. I know what people are saying out there. I know all those things that you think are pretty damn good. But I'll tell you what, the ruling class has a firm handle on this empire. And they're not going to let it go without a struggle. I mean a real blood and gut struggle. So I tell you to keep your powder dry for a longer time. That's Tommy's opinion.
Well, that article was obviously not written by our friends, if we have any friends. But the reason I put these on is because they bring out some correct points. And if you're going to listen, and if you're going to have any effect on defeating your opposition, you got to listen to what they say. And mainly behind closed doors sometimes, that happens to get out. And also the so-called intellectuals of the opposition. You've got to listen to them. Now, you see, here we go back into the German thing, which is going to drive all the Hollywood Nazis crazy. It was the conservatives in Germany, you know, the industrialists, the large landowners, the militarism and so forth, that put him in there. Because he was losing, he was not winning at the ballot box. At the end there, he only had 32%, which is a lot, but not enough to put him in power. So the people now that hide out there and say, well, it wasn't us, it was those dirty Nazis. Well, those dirty Nazis wouldn't have been in there if it hadn't been for all these economic powerhouses putting them there. Same in the First World War. The First World War, after the First World War, led to a lot of this anti-Jew animosity, which had not been that great in Germany except for traditional so-called anti-Semitism, which was always around. But when those Eastern European Jews, the more Asiatic end of the Jews, started invading Germany, like these people have invaded these countries in Europe now, they would set up their cardboard or their tables on the streets and be dealing in money and gold and so forth right out in the open, which the Ashkenazi Jews, which were more assimilated in Germany, were aghast. In fact, in the beginning, they supported Hitler. So it's all these kind of things that go into the chemistry that leads to the big problems. Now, my position is that how can you say that you're defending and fighting for the white race when you are waging war against white people? When you're killing, when you're part of the destruction of 55 million people, most of them white, across Europe and Russia, England, and so forth, how can you legitimately say that you were doing this for the white race? Well, I think it was sort of euphemistically, it was Germanic, supposedly Germanic race, not the Aryan race in totality, or not whites in totality. If we know anything today, it's the attack on the entire family of tribes of white people from Russia all the way across Europe and all the way across the United States. So what the guy's saying is there is a similarity, because even though Trump has got a lot of people excited as a racial separatist, you got to understand he's promoting more big armies, more big weapons, more big bombs, and even talking about threatening other countries that way, which puts him in the same class as our absolute enemies. also, and of course he is falsely, of course, playing a game of trying to attract more blacks into his camp, using some really extreme rhetoric to get them into his camp, which, you know, he's not going to do. He doesn't care. And but yet our people, white people, I'm not saying our people as racial separatists, they are going right along with this. Come on, blacks, we love you. We're going to give you more money and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, the blacks should never trust corrupt whites to give them anything. They shouldn't trust corrupt blacks to do it either, but they do. Now, there's thousands of white people out there that consider themselves racist, or they don't consider themselves racist, but they are racist. Yeah, and they're not going the same way we're going, if we're going anywhere. They're going to vote for whoever throws them a bone, or supposedly a bone. They never get it. Remember all these elections? I've been through a lot of them, and we never got anything. Very few whites did get what they wanted. But that part of the struggle is all economics. You know, economies change. Races change now, too. You can see that with the mulatto race on the rise. The Jews and the ruling class of whites say, oh, you don't like black niggers? Okay, what kind do you want? We'll give you mulatto, we'll give you coffee colored, we'll give you tea colored, we'll give you any color nigger you want. And we'll put them in the movies, and we'll put them on all the advertising on TV, your colored TV, which now is almost, well, it's 50, 60, 70% occupied by Negroes in the ads, and a giant share of new shows coming on with preponderance of blacks. Or they're not blacks, they're mulattoes. They're the ha-ha blacks. The question you should ask your white neighbor is, how's that colored TV working out for you? And, of course, the capitalists, the neocons and the capitalists and these people just keep rolling along, gathering more power all the time. And don't worry about whether it's Democrat or Republican, they're running both parties, you know. So they're moving us towards international conflicts, of which more millions of white people will be killed, along with millions of other people. So going out to vote coming up for Tweedledum or Tweedledee is ridiculous. And the presidency of Hillary Clinton would be a disaster, but I think the presidency of Donald Trump would be a disaster too. At least it wouldn't do anything for the racial separatist cause. So our problem again is our own race. The whites that are in leadership of the economy and the military and so forth, these are our worst enemies. They're much worse in my enemy than ISIS. ISIS is not my enemy. ISIS is over there. ISIS is doing what they want to do over there. Well, that's their business. Yeah, they'll ultimately lose, but they'll just transform into another name and go on. But if ISIS or any of these people were going to do anything in this country, they could have really tore this country up. They're resting on the laurels of the Twin Towers. And, of course, I think we all agree that that had mixed origins, not just of Saudi Arabians, but people in power that wanted something to happen. It wasn't just those Saudi guys with knives. No. So that one piece of so-called terrorism has carried forth the myth that the terrorists are invading the United States and going to blow everything up, which the FBI encourages by setting up small explosions or attempted explosions by small fry people or maybe small groups, and then they stop them in the act and they make a big deal in the newspapers and the television about how the FBI is protecting our asses. Oh man, this thing is so filthy, so rotten, it's irredeemable. It's got to crash. What comes afterwards, I don't know. But don't lose sleep worrying about voting some prick into office, male or female, because you're getting the same thing. They'll just package it a little differently. So you should be putting out the sign, none of the above. However, I think that even may be a waste of time because these people are beyond that. They're beyond it. You can't talk to them. If I was to set up a card table in downtown on the village square and say what I want to say, I'd have them trying to kill me. White people. Probably the blacks wouldn't be trying to kill me because I understand the black situation. Or even the mestizo situation. I understand it. Anyhow, that's my position, and I'm sticking to it, and it's not going to be real popular or popular at all, probably, except with a few people who can see through the bullshit. But we're going to keep doing it, at least a few of us, and a few of us, our kids, may know what happened after this whole thing comes tumbling down like 9/11. Only the whole culture is going to come down like 9/11. It's not going to be just a couple of buildings. 14/5, and I'll see you Moonsday. We'll see if we can make you even happier. Joy to the world. Or boo, it's Halloween. Before I go, here's another little article that is designed to drive you crazy and keep you up at night. The National Security Priesthood in Washington has always used claims of superior wisdom and insider knowledge to silence dissent about nuclear policy. But not even they can explain any longer why U.S. nuclear bombs are being stored in a politically unstable Turkey as it grows increasingly Islamist and anti-American. Anti-Washington, I would say. Anti-Wall Street. I don't think any of these countries are anti the average American. The Incirlik Air Base in southeast Turkey, from which U.S. pilots launched bombing raids on ISIS forces in Syria, is home of about 50 B-61 hydrogen bombs. 50! That makes it NATO's largest nuclear storage facility, with about a quarter of all theater nuclear weapons in the alliance's stockpiles. I don't know about you, but all this nuclear stuff drives me crazy. I mean, it's insane. And the people who are in charge of it are even more insane. And the Jews that created the dirty bomb were insane. Even Einstein opposed it. Each bomb has a yield of up to 170 kilotons, nearly a dozen times more powerful than the weapon that leveled Hiroshima. The bombs are stored in underground vaults within aircraft shelters that in turn are protected by a base security perimeter. Well, I don't know about the powerful bombs, but I know one thing, that the amount of bombs they've dropped on Syria and Afghanistan and Iraq would probably total enough for a few atomic bombs already, but nuclear, regular bombs. But Eric Schlosser, author of the 2014 book on the perils of nuclear accidents, observed recently, quote, "With a few hours and right tools and training, you could open one of NATO's nuclear weapon storage vaults, remove a weapon, and bypass the protective switches inside it. Within seconds, you could place an explosive device on top of a storage vault, destroy the weapon, and release lethal radioactive cloud. In addition, the security of the bombs is premised on them being defended by loyal NATO forces," whoever that is. In the case of Incirlik, that loyalty proved uncertain at best. Power to the base was cut after mutinous troops used a tanker plane with the base to refuel F-16s that menaced Ankara and Istanbul. After the coup, the Turkish commander of Incirlik was arrested for complicity and marched off in handcuffs. One can easily imagine a clique of Islamist officers in a future coup seizing the nukes as a bargaining chip with Ankara and Washington, or worse yet, to support radical insurgents in the region. After years of inattention to NATO's nuclear deployment policy, the recent failed coup in Turkey is finally setting off alarm bells. Jeffrey Lewis, a nuclear proliferation expert at the Monterey Institute for International Affairs, asked rhetorically, "Does it seem like a good idea to station American nuclear weapons at an airbase commanded by someone who may have just helped bomb his own country's parliament?" F-15 Eagles from the 493rd Fighter Squadron at Royal Air Force Base, Lackenheath, England, taxi to the runway during the final day of the Anatolian Eagle, June 18, 2015, at 3rd Main Jet Base, Turkey. The 493rd FS recently received the 2014 Raytheon Trophy as the U.S. Air Force Top Fighter Squadron. Hans Christensen, a nuclear expert with the Federation of American Scientists, declared that the security situation in Turkey and in the base area no longer meets safety requirements that the United States should have for storage of nuclear weapons. "You only get so many warnings before something goes terribly wrong. It's time to withdraw the weapons." But will they? I think not. Most tellingly, former NATO Supreme Commander James Severodis wrote, "Being careful not to publicly conform any classified information, that if NATO really does house tactical nuclear weapons at Incirlik air base, it poses a very dangerous problem, and Washington will need Ankara's full cooperation to ensure that all U.S. military equipment and forces are fully protected. Yeah, by their ragtag army. Huh. Totally infiltrated by whoever. The questioning should go beyond the obvious security risks of loose nukes falling into unfriendly hands, however. No one has ever explained what enemy and hydrogen bombs stored in Turkey might be used against. A quarter century after the fall of the Soviet Union, no doubt there are plenty of neocons, war beaters in Washington, who would delight in dropping them on Iran. As advocated by Republican billionaire Jew Sheldon Adelson, but one hopes that most Americans do not share his fondness for gambling outside the casinos. Well, most Americans don't give a shit. And most Americans would say, yeah, let's drop a nuke on Iran. See how that ends. Nor has anyone explained how the bombs might be used if appropriate enemy were found. Since NATO has no nuclear certified aircraft stationed in Turkey, but in Washington and in Brussels, the inability to answer such basic questions is rarely a cause to rethink old policies. After all, how many priests give up their incantations just because the chants don't work? Although Turkey offers an egregious case of nuclear risk, questions about nuclear weapons deployment should go well beyond the country. Security is also notoriously lax at NATO bases in Belgium and in the Netherlands, where nuclear weapons are stored. As Schlosser recalls, in 2010, peace activists climbed over a fence in Klein-Brogel Air Base in Belgium, cutting through the second fence, entering a hardened shelter containing nuclear weapons vaults, placed anti-nuclear stickers on the walls, and wandered the base for an hour, and posted a video of the intrusion on YouTube. The video showed that the Belgian soldier who finally confronted them was carrying an unloaded rifle. This reminds me of Camp Pendleton, California, when allegedly war associates were able to enter a nuclear storage facility and put war stickers all over their nuclear weapons. That never got out much. As I have argued before, the threat of terrorism is only one of several reasons to rethink the presence of the theater nuclear weapons on NATO soil. Those weapons actually decrease the security of Western Europe by raising risks of catastrophic escalations in the case of inadvertent conflict with Russia. You know, this would be just like Germany going to war and getting everybody else got into it and killing 55 million people to help them out, to set them free, to make them more money and so forth. But did it? No, it just wiped out Europe. I've argued before the threat of terrorism is only one of several reasons to rethink the presence of theater nuclear weapons on NATO soil. Those weapons actually decrease the security of Western Europe by raising the risk of catastrophic escalations in the case of inadvertent conflict with Russia. I just read that, dummy. The weapons are also utterly unnecessary for deterrence given the nuclear arsenals available in the United States, Great Britain, and France. Oh, yeah, they're everywhere. Dr. Strangelove. You gotta watch that movie. You gotta watch Dr. Strangelove with Peter Sellers. Despite these risks, influential voices in the alliance are calling for brandishing of nuclear weapons, not less. A recent article in the NATO Review declared the forces involved in the nuclear mission should be exercised openly and regularly without undermining their specific nature. That's gobbledygook. Such exercises should involve not only nuclear weapon states, but other non-nuclear allies. This ally thing is a bunch of bullshit. Last December, Poland's deputy defense minister proposed putting U.S. nuclear weapons on Polish soil. We need that like a hole in the head. That proposal came a year after Polish F-16s took part in a NATO nuclear exercise. And the Obama administration, for now at least, remains bent on upgrading this hydrogen bomb situation and building a new class of nuclear-tipped cruise missiles, both of which would be deployed in Europe. Sociopath and insane. These people are sociopaths and they're insane. Yet the observation of German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier remains as true as today as when he said it in 2009. Quote, from the military point of view, those theater weapons are absolutely senseless today, unquote. The question he asked then is the one that all thinking people should be asking in the wake of Turkey's recent debacle. Quote, isn't it time to include sub-strategic and tactical nuclear weapons in the nuclear disarmament process in order to eliminate once and for all the leftovers of the Cold War on the territory of Russia and Europe? There you go. I'm telling you, boys and girls, the American people don't even think about this argument. They're not thinking about it. White people, majority of white people, they're for this nuclear crap. They go run around saying, "Yeah, oh, let's bomb Iran, oh, bomb Iran," because they took some guys off a rowboat and held them overnight. Oh, bomb them, bomb them. Even that coward McCain, bomb Iran. Yeah, remember that? See you later, boys and girls. Keep your powder dry on your nuclear missiles. Yeah. They're going to do it one of these days. I will guarantee you that nuclear bombs will be used very early in this century.